And now, without further ado, I'd like to turn the call over to your first speaker for today, Andreas Kollat. You now have the floor. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hello, everyone. This is Andreas. I will be your moderator of the water reuse webinar for today. I'm calling from Germany, and welcome everyone, no matter from where you are calling in from. We have a great panel for you today, and I also need to say that this webinar is co-sponsored by the IUVA and the NSF, and so we are also proud to present presentations from both of the organizations today as well. Our speakers are, and there I need to make the first correction, we unfortunately don't have George Jablonegus speaking today because he is serving in a jury and actually has to go to a court today because of that. But we have a great replacement for him because the co-author of his presentation is going to give his one, and this is Dr. Harold Leverenz. I will introduce him as everyone else just before every presentation. Just to, introduce the reuse topic very, very briefly, there are many different aspects with reuse, and certainly we can't cover everything in all the details within 1.5 hours. So we decided to really, focus on the U.S. as a region and really introduce and speak about direct and indirect potable reuse, focus more on the municipal arena rather than industrial applications, although there are also, reuse applications in the industry, of course. We will also, more focus on wastewater and groundwaters than surface water or gray waters. And having said that, if we would do a webinar like that in Germany and focus on that market, then it would be completely the other way around. So if you have a look at unplanned reuse, which is actually something like river bank filtration, we have the River Rhine here, where a lot of water supplies take the water from. But that's not today's issue, so we are focusing on more U.S. Issues today. So to give you some numbers, the U.S. reclaims about 6.5% of treated wastewater, and this equals about 2.3 billion gallons a day. So this is a large amount of water. However, if you compare that to other countries, you see, this could be more. In Israel, they reclaim 70%. In Singapore, they reclaim 30%. And in Australia, they reclaim 8% with a goal to be at 50% in 2015. There are 308 projects across the planet which are focusing on, potable and direct and non-direct potable reuse. So this is a, fast-growing market, and that's why we thought, it's definitely worth to have a webinar around it. So with that, I would, introduce the first speaker of today, who will focus on the direct potable reuse topic. And this is Dr. Harold Leverenz. He has been involved in the modeling and pilot testing of technologies and processes for sustainable water and wastewater management for the past 15 years. And he has a degree from the Michigan State University in biosystems engineering and completed his doctorate in environmental engineering at the University of California at Davis, UC Davis. And he is a registered civil engineer in California and conducts research in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at UC Davis as well. So, Harold, please go ahead, and we're curious to hear about direct potable reuse then.
Great. Thank you. So, sorry that that George couldn't be here this morning. He was called away. But luckily, I'm here to fill in. So George and I collaborated on this presentation on direct potable reuse. So we have a few topics to kind of frame the discussion, and these are basically more like a general considerations for potable overuse of wastewater. So the overview is, let's see. So the basic topics to talk about today are kind of how to think about wastewater, and then an overview of direct and indirect potable reuse, and how we now have a lot of unplanned or de facto type of reuse going on. Then we'll a quick review of some technologies for direct potable reuse, and then a discussion of the factors that are limiting and also driving potable reuse. So the basic message that we have is that wastewater is a renewable, recoverable source of energy, resources, and potable water. And this really creates that we need to think about wastewater differently. So ultimately, if we want to recycle the greatest amount of water, we need to really look at potable reuse. We think it's inevitable type of reuse because it really lets us maximize the amount of reuse that's possible. So if we look at this schematic where we kind of a definition sketch of different types of water reuse, we have, you know, water coming from groundwater and surface water sources. And when we get to the wastewater treatment aspect, if we go through the treatment train for potable reuse, we have right now what's used commonly is kind of conventional wastewater treatment through membranes and advanced oxidation, chemical balancing. And if we go to the top, where we have indirect potable reuse, which is commonly done in Singapore and in Orange County, we go through an environmental buffer and then recycle back for potable reuse. And in direct potable reuse, what we're talking about is coming back through after treatment and coming directly back in blending with water supply. And so the main difference is that in direct potable reuse, we don't have an environmental buffer, so we're not recycling the water back through groundwater or surface water. And one other note, there's a dashed line there where we show that an alternative approach is to bypass any kind of buffer that would be used now with direct potable reuse. So right now, in direct potable reuse, we really think about having an engineered storage buffer that we use to kind of validate and ensure the water quality. So it's basically like a holdup in the for monitoring of the recycled water before it's returned to the community. And what we think is that in the future, as the technology for sensors and monitoring improve, that we won't even require any type of buffer between the final water quality and before it's recycled back to the community, because we'll be able to have real-time assurance of water quality and therefore won't require any buffer. if we could just go back to that slide for one second. One further note, and the main difference with the indirect potable reuse, is that if we take this water and we're going to go through an environmental buffer like groundwater or a reservoir, that we kind of lose control of water quality when we put the water back into the ground or if we put it into a surface water reservoir because of unknowns in the environment. So we think that this is a main advantage of direct potable reuse, is that we eliminate environmental unknowns of recycling this water through the environment. Okay, next slide. And we understand that there's, you know, some public concerns related to potable reuse. And we think that, you know, when people understand all the issues associated with modern, unplanned, and de facto reuse, that people are much more accepting of direct potable and indirect potable reuse. And here's an example showing the Colorado River watershed. And if you look, you know, water coming from Utah and from Colorado through the Colorado River, through several states before it gets to Southern California in this example. And there's nearly 300 NPDS, or wastewater discharge permits, for the Colorado River before it gets to Southern California. And not only that, there's also a significant amount of agricultural, urban runoff into this watershed. And so when people understand that the water quality that's getting into their water supply is a function of all this upstream activity, that people are much more accepting of using technology to purify water when they start to understand the issue of de facto or unplanned reuse, which is occurring already. So the basic treatment train, and I think we're going to hear about this as we go through today, is taking water after conventional type of wastewater treatment, and then tertiary treatment by typically by membranes, cartridge filters to filter out any impurities in the chemical treatment prior to reverse osmosis, advanced oxidation to oxidize any trace organics that made it through the RO membranes, and then finally chemical balancing by usually addition of carbonate and minerals and stripping off CO2. And then in this case for Orange County, being injected back into the groundwater supply. But again, I think the question that that we ask is, what's the fate of this water that we've treated back basically to purified water if we inject that back into the ground? And, you know, what's what type of constituents is it going to pick up when it's in the ground? So this is basically the same treatment train that we would use for direct potable reuse, and the only difference is that instead of this environmental buffer, which is could be a groundwater or surface water basin, that we would put it into an engineered storage buffer where we'd validate the water quality before distribution. The next slide. Here are a few photos related to that treatment train for the Orange County Water District. And you can see the in the top left microfiltration membranes, the cartridge filters to the right, and down below the reverse osmosis banks and the advanced oxidation system. And this is basically the same technologies that would be used, we believe, at nearly any modern potable reuse facility. So a consideration of the factors that really limit other types of reuse when we're talking about non-potable reuse. And we would like to recycle water to agriculture because agriculture has a large demand for water, but unfortunately because of the nature of urbanization and urban development, agricultural regions are not located near where wastewater resources are at. Agriculture is farther and farther away from cities where the water supply would be coming from. And for landscape irrigation, again, it's a seasonal use, a lot like agriculture maybe, and also it's a dispersed use, so it's expensive to put in the parallel distribution system to bring recycled water back into for landscape irrigation, which also has a relatively low value for water. And for indirect potable reuse, which makes sense in some communities, but many communities don't have the proper hydrology, either the surface water storage basins or the groundwater basins, to make indirect potable reuse really feasible. And then a few considerations of factors that are really driving direct potable reuse is that the value of water is increasing, and it's going to continue to increase. And really, treating water back to purified water maximizes the value of water. We understand that there's infrastructure requirements that limit reuse in many communities. We know about population growth and global warming that's changing the nature of water supply and resulting in additional water shortages. Potable reuse really is probably the most reliable alternative supply that's available because you're recovering all the water and recycling it back to the community. Nobody, I think, is in favor of de facto reuse where there's really very little control over water quality once it's back in the environment and not even considering the impacts of kind of conventional wastewater treatment on ecosystems, especially aquatic ecosystems. And we think that, the existing technology is already capable of making this a possibility and at lower costs than other types of water supply. And the technology is improving pretty rapidly. Finally, the environmental regulations with discharge of and reuse of kind of conventional and non-potable reuse are becoming more stringent. So we think that to really kind of embrace potable reuse, what we need to do is think of wastewater differently. Think of it as a resource and not a byproduct or something that needs to be disposed of. We need to look at new treatment plant designs that are more reliable and can produce water that we can that is suitable as a feedstock for potable reuse. Think about new strategies to integrate water and wastewater management together. That way we can have an integrated system and really make it possible to do these types of projects. And finally, we believe that planning needs to occur now so we're ready for the future. And here's our kind of thesis again, that basically wastewater is a renewable resource. It contains energy and potable water, and these are and also nutrients that should be recycled. And really, potable reuse makes all this a possibility.
Thank you very much, Harold, for the interesting introduction and also giving us the heads up on the direct possible reuse. We directly come to the next presentation. I see we get questions in, so please continue posting questions, which we can address at the end of all the sessions. But now we continue with the presentation from Kathy Chang. Dr. Kathy Chang is the Water Quality Program Manager at the Water Replenishment District of Southern California. She oversees the Water Quality Program and works on projects related to recycled water reuse, seawater intrusion, spreading ground, stormwater capture and recharge, and regulatory compliance. She is a California professional civil engineer with over 15 years of experience in the water quality field. So with that, I'm handing it over to you, Kathy.
Thank you. Good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are. I'm going to provide a quick synopsis of indirect potable reuse, specifically about groundwater recharge projects using recycled water in Southern California. Indirect potable reuse, by putting the recycled water into an environmental buffer, such as an aquifer or surface reservoir, helps to ease the yuck factor that's associated with the toilet-to-tap concept by removing the product recycled water further away from its source. Here we're looking at the 2009 recycled water use data that was compiled by the State Water Resources Control Board, and I just wanted to highlight that the total volume of recycled water that's generated and used is estimated at 669,000 acre-feet, or roughly 825 million cubic meters. And nearly half of that amount is used for some sort of irrigation, followed by groundwater recharge, which in this pie chart is broken down into groundwater recharge and seawater intrusion, which combined represent about 20% of the total pie. So I hear a little echo. I don't know if that's just me. But in California, the actual recycled water that's produced and used is actually on the rise, as shown in blue. So are the goals as well as the mandates for using recycled water, as shown in gold and red. And we still have a significant ways to go for the actual use to converge with the recycled water use goals. So for sake of time, I won't go through all the drivers for using recycled water for groundwater recharge in California, but we do have periods of prolonged droughts in the state, and the cost of importing potable water from Northern California and also Colorado River keeps on increasing, with the reliability of the imported supply becoming more uncertain over time. So for all these reasons, we want to increase the use of locally produced water. Just a quick look at the for Southern California, the various groundwater recharge projects using recycled water. There are about 7 of them, and they span over several counties, including the Los Angeles County, which includes the Central Basin and West Coast Basin. And I'll explain further in the coming slides, but there are two types of recharge projects, namely the surface spreading, which uses spreading basins, and then the injection projects, which uses injection wells. And here, looking at this map, projects 2 through 5, which are coastally located, are seawater intrusion barrier projects, which I'll go into further detail a little bit later. And then the remainder are the spreading basins. A quick look at the specific area for our case study, on which I'll base my discussions of recharge on, is located in South Los Angeles County within California, where there are 4 groundwater recharge projects. And this area has about 400 production wells, which helps to serve about 4 million people. And annually, there's about 250,000 acre feet, or 308 million cubic meters of groundwater is pumped on an annual basis. One of the 4 recharge projects in this area is the Montebello 4-bay spreading grounds. And for this surface application, in addition to recycled water, stormwater and imported potable water are also used as a source of recharge water. And over the last 50 years or so, about 1.5 million acre-foot of water, roughly 1.85 billion cubic meter of recycled water has been recharged at the basins. And our ultimate goal for this project is to increase the use of recycled water and also stormwater in order to be able to wean ourselves off of imported water completely for the purpose of recharging the basins. In concept, the spreading basins work sort of like a leaky lake overlying an area that's hydrogeologically suitable for percolation. And then the other 3 recharge projects in South Los Angeles County consist of seawater barrier wells. Their main purpose is to combat the intrusion of seawater, which happens because the water levels at the production wells have been lowered below that of the sea level due to prolonged overpumping that has occurred in the past before the adjudications by the courts were in place. In the 2 basins in South Los Angeles County, over 100,000 acre-feet of recycled water has been injected to date, and all 3 barrier projects currently use imported water to dilute recycled water due to the current regulatory requirements, although in most cases the quality of recycled water that's injected actually exceeds that of the potable water. However, all 3 projects are in various stages of becoming a 100% recycled water project. And just a little animation to show you how the injection wells work. All right, so in the next set of slides, I'm going to briefly highlight some of the major components of the regulations for recycled water that's used for groundwater recharge projects. CDPH on this slide refers to the California Department of Public Health, which is the primary agency that regulates drinking water and recycled water use. And recycled water is regulated for total organic carbon, which is basically an indicator of the overall treatment performance as well as the removal efficiency. And then it's also regulated for nitrogen compounds and pathogens, which can have acute health effects. Then recycled water must be retained underground for a set amount of time. And then the level of treatment that the recycled water must go through is also specified in the regulations. And then there's the monitoring that's required for the constituents of emerging concern, including pharmaceuticals and personal care products. And then this slide refers to the November 2011 version of the draft regulations. I just wanted to point out that the latest revisions to the draft regs were posted to the agency website on March 28th. However, the main requirements remain the same. While spreading projects can use tertiary treated recycled water, injection barrier projects require the use of advanced treated recycled water that has undergone a treatment process similar to what's shown here, because the water that's directly injected into the aquifer, thereby bypassing the shallower zones, it must be of higher quality. The CDPH regulations also require specific log removals for pathogens, namely 12 logs removal for virus, 10 logs for Giardia, and 10 logs for Cryptosporidium. And this must be achieved using multiple treatment barriers, including above-ground treatment as well as underground retention time. Now, CDPH has also required that each groundwater recharge project sponsor to make sure that their recycled water remains underground for a sufficient amount of time so that they're able to provide the necessary response in case of a potential treatment failure. And this really provides another layer of protection or buffer. And this is really the main difference between what separates the indirect potable reuse from the direct potable reuse projects. Now, here's a sample monitoring program that our agency came up with for a barrier expansion project for monitoring constituents of emerging concern, and it's based on the latest regulations by the State Water Resources Control Board. It's a relatively short list, and the intent here is to really pick out a few constituents that could serve as indicators for other constituents of emerging concern. And there's also a couple of surrogates, such as the total organic carbon and conductivity, which can give a measure of the overall treatment performance and removal efficiency. In summary, recycled water has been used successfully for groundwater recharge for over 50 years in South Los Angeles County. It's proven to be an effective and safe source, and it's rigorously regulated as well as monitored to make sure that human health and the environment is protected. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much, Kathy. That was a, you know, excellent overview about the indirect reuse and also, you know, regulatory requirements. With that, I would like to come to the next presenter, who is Tom Bruzema. He's a sustainability expert with more than 24 years of experience in product certification and professional accreditation within domestic and international markets. And he currently serves as the general manager of the NSF's International Sustainability Division, which helps companies develop standardized objective methods of measuring sustainability that instill marketplace confidence and promote acceptance of more sustainable products and services. And we will hear about, you know, NSF standards now. With that, I'm handing over to you, Tom.
Thank you, Andreas. Hello, everyone. So the focus of my presentation will be on a slightly different aspect, which is on what I would refer to as decentralized or on-site treatment, meaning treatment within the building or the facility of water generated in that facility and then reused in that facility. And I'll talk about it in the context of some American national standards that have been developed. So as you contrast that then with the centralized infrastructure, which many would describe currently as aging, perhaps in many cases undersized, certainly expensive to repair and expand, and often designed around one particular high level of treatment, such as for drinking water quality, as opposed to lower qualities, which may be used for other applications. On top of that, certainly available sources of water have been dwindling, and the quality of those sources have been on the decline. So it presents some opportunities, in the context of reuse of water on site. That water, it's already available on site at the property of the building, so there's very little infrastructure or additional infrastructure needed or energy required to transport it to a central facility and bring it back to keep it on site. A large percentage of the water that's generated would have a fairly modest level of contamination if you segmented from combined wastewater, gray water, rainwater, stormwater from that facility. You can treat it as an individual stream, which gives you some advantages in the treatment side of it. Many existing technologies are available for those types of treatments. And then, of course, it can be used in different applications depending upon the particular need, whether that's potable, non-potable type of applications. So the same is with central treatment. Certainly decentralized or on-site treatment offers the same opportunities with a variety of sources, whether that be rainfall or stormwater from nature or from human-generated waste, such as with gray water and residential wastewater. And certainly there's research done to show that there's a high amount of water that's consumed within a building that is within the gray water or less contaminant load context that presents some opportunities for treatment and for reuse. Reuse applications, certainly there are many in the context of non-potable. Potable, certainly, obviously, in the context of this webinar, is another possibility. The standards that we'll be speaking about are addressing it currently in the case of non-potable. But the methodology exists in a very similar way to allow for potable applications, which are also being looked upon favorably more and more so in the marketplace with decentralized technologies. So the standards development process that we use at NSF, it's a consensus building process. We bring together product manufacturers, user groups, as well as the regulatory community, and facilitate the generation of an American National Standard, which then gets published and becomes in the public domain for anyone to use and apply. And when I speak of standards, I'm referring to a method of evaluating a treatment technology and then the criteria against which that technology is judged. So these are very detailed standards that go into how to undertake an assessment of that treatment technology, specific, again, in this case, for reuse applications and for on-site treatment or decentralized, if you will, treatment. So there are currently two standards, 350 and 350-1. 350 is the broadest in terms of the scope. It's specific to a variety of non-potable applications that I'll speak in more detail. 350-1 is essentially a mirror image of 350, but for a slightly poorer effluent quality, which would be limited to subsurface applications only. So the scope of 350, again, in the context of on-site treatment, deals in both residential as well as commercial systems. So these would be systems that would treat whether it's a single residence or a small community or even a commercial application such as an apartment building or a school system. It looks at several different sources, including gray water, which would be both laundry and bathing, which in our definition of gray water would exclude anything from the toilet, of course, but also from the kitchen. It deals in combined, meaning all of the wastewater generated from a residence or a facility, and then also the commercial application, which gets much broader in looking at other sources, including rainwater and stormwater. And again, it's limited at this point to the effluent uses in a non-potable application, looking at things both indoor as well as outdoor. But again, the methodology would enable the use in potable applications going forward with just some adjustments to the effluent criteria, which I'll come back to. So just to give some definition for commercial facilities, these are really businesses such as lodging establishments, parks, campuses, shopping facilities. Really what we're trying to avoid is industrial complexes, food processing or water from industrial applications, from food processing, or even in those cases of laundering facilities where there's a very high level of soiling or high strength cleaners that might be included within the water supply. So the requirements, again, as these standards relate to the evaluating the treatment technology, they deal in a number of different areas that you likely expect a treatment system would be evaluated against, things like noise and access and failure sensing, and all the way up to, obviously, including a very robust evaluation of its ability to treat the water to proper effluent quality requirements. So if you think about it in the residential side, we do a number of evaluations today for decentralized treatment technologies, though they are not for direct reuse applications. So we apply this standard to take some of those same lessons learned in how we evaluate treatment technologies. In this case, for combined wastewater, we look at fairly standard BOD and suspended solids loading, and there are treatment facilities across the country that would enable the evaluations of these technologies using an actual wastewater stream. So there's already infrastructure there to allow for that. The same not true, however, for gray water in terms of treatment facilities available for evaluating or test facilities for evaluating these technologies. So in that case, the committee developed an actual synthetic wastewater, gray water, looking at available research, published information that was available, and actually generated a recipe, if you will, to create actual gray water. So this one is dealt more in a true laboratory environment where the water is prepared. So the test conditions, again, this would all be in the context of a residential system. Commercial is slightly different, so if you continue to think about in the residential applications, these would be done in actual test facilities or laboratory environments where the test is run for a minimum six-month period, so it's a fairly lengthy test. No service or maintenance is allowed, so it's really meant to be in a test of the system to perform over a period of time without a lot of tweaking or adjustment. And all the data is then reported and available through the manufacturer, through the regulatory department, which would be evaluating these systems for compliance or approval. The effluent criteria that we applied, we looked at many different state level, national, the EPA guidelines, international requirements that exist around reuse applications, again, specific to non-potable in this case. And we essentially distilled that down to almost kind of a best practice that's available in the marketplace today, being a little bit conservative in those requirements. And we have two different classifications in the context of Standard 350. An R is purely residential, single-family dwellings, and a C is either multifamily or commercial. And if you look down, BOD, suspended solids, turbidity, E. coli, pH, and chlorine residual, though it's not limited only to chlorine, but you'll see these are fairly standard parameters across many of the reuse applications. The number in parentheses is a single maximum effluent value, and we collect roughly about 100 samples throughout that 6 months. So there's a fair amount of data that's collected. The others are overall test averages. And you can see commercial is slightly tighter in terms of its criteria for turbidity and E. coli, just with the expectation there that there would be a broader exposure potential to the individuals within those applications, whereas a single-family dwelling is a little more contained in terms of its exposure. And I mentioned early on, 350-1 is a poor effluent quality subsurface discharge only, and you can see that's limited just to a BOD and suspended solids. There's no disinfection requirements related to that standard. So again, the standard largely is a method of evaluating. This is the criteria in the standard to say, yes, I comply with that standard. There certainly are states that may elect to have more rigid requirements than these. It doesn't make the methodology inappropriate for those technologies. It simply means that this effluent criteria would be slightly different if a state decided to go beyond these. And then, of course, the same would be true for a potable application. Of course, the effluent criteria would need to change to match with the potable application. So in summary, the NSF standards really are meant to be a proper testing and effluent criteria to give the technologies in the marketplace recognition and acceptance, particularly from a regulatory standpoint, recognizing that many of these will require that type of approval and permitting. But it's just one piece. There's a lot happening within the codes, for example, to enable this, as well as within the regulatory compliance arena to enable these types of systems to be used, all of which is necessary in addition to the standards and in addition to the evaluation to enable that that usage. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom. That was a very good overview about, what I would say from very big projects to, smaller applications, decentralized wastewater, and the regulations linked to that application. There are a couple of questions which we can address afterwards, but I already see them. But before that, we have our last presenter for today, and we will now focus more on, one particular technology, which is the application of UV rays to water and in water reuse applications. And the presenter will be Dr. Catherine Bell. She's a principal engineer with CDM Smith with over 16 years of experience in research, the selection, design, and optimization of water and wastewater processes. And Katie's research is focused primarily on the implementation of new technologies and improving conventional processes to meet increasingly stringent regulatory limits on both waste, water and wastewater disinfection across the country. And apart from her role with CDM Smith, she's on the executive board of the International UV Association. She's actually the treasurer She's on the Water Research Foundation PEC member. She's a committee member at the American Water Works Association Disinfection Systems and also a committee member at the Water Environment Foundation Disinfection and Public Health Group. So, Katie, with that, I'm handing it over to you.
Thank you so much, Andreas. I'm very happy to be here today to talk a little bit about one of the very important technologies that we apply in reuse applications. And so one of the things I wanted to do with respect to discussing UV in this application is lay out some of the regulatory frameworks that we have in the U.S., show you a short list of some of the IPR and DPR projects worldwide, and really talk about how UV is an important part of making reuse fit for its purpose, regardless of whether it's indirect potable reuse, direct potable reuse, or other non-potable uses. I'll talk specifically about UV for disinfection, as well as UV as its role in advanced oxidation processes. There is a regulatory framework in the U.S. The EPA does not have federal regulations. There are guidelines, and actually I was very honored to be involved in the development of the 2012 update to the EPA guidelines. That's available for free download. The website's shown on this slide, and I have it again on our last summary slide. But really, in the U.S., reuse is implemented on a state-by-state basis, and that allows individual states to address regional issues, which are very different from state to state. There are currently no states in the United States that have DPR rules, although that may be coming soon, and there are indirect potable reuse rules in 9 states already. So I think that's an important point to bring forward. When we talk about some of the UV applications for these uses. So UV, as I mentioned, is used for disinfection and advanced oxidation. And when we look at what the other available technologies are for disinfection, we look at chlorine, ozone. There are some innovative and emerging technologies such as pasteurization that are being approved for reuse. There are some advantages to UV disinfection. You do reduce handling of chemicals. You eliminate the formation of halogenated disinfection byproducts. And in certain applications, you can turn that UV disinfection system into an advanced oxidation process. And so you get sort of a double bang for your buck. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in the next few slides. I did want to show you out of the EPA guidelines, one of the chapters has a pretty detailed discussion of some of the information that Harold and George presented earlier, and one of the tables out of the guidelines shows some of our worldwide IPR and DPR projects. This is not a comprehensive list of potable reuse projects, but those highlighted in blue are all projects that use UV, whether it's in a disinfection mode for bacterial compliance or in an advanced oxidation mode. So it's obviously a very important piece of the reuse treatment train. So one of the things I want to do is take you through what I think is a fairly geographically diverse list of case studies, 2 in disinfection applications and then 2 in advanced oxidation applications. But before we do that, I want to highlight what the mechanism of inactivation for bacteria and viruses is using UV disinfection. We know that UV in the 200 to 280 nanometer range is absorbed by genetic material in microorganisms, and that causes dimerization of base pairs, and in effect, that prevents those organisms from reproducing. So it's important to note that we haven't actually killed or destroyed those organisms. We just simply inactivate them and so therefore make them non-pathogenic. The benefit is that this is a biophysical process, and we are not adding chemicals into the water that can result in formation of disinfection byproducts. So one of the case studies that I want to highlight on the east side of the country where we are considered to be water rich is a project in Clayton County, Georgia. This actually is a project that started in the 1970s as a land application system. The wastewater treatment plant was using a wetland scenario for polishing the effluent before it was discharged into the water supply for the county. And this is a project that's had excellent performance. It is very successful, and UV is implemented in the water reclamation process in order to meet NPDES permit compliance for fecal organism compliance. And so you can see a picture of that here, and you can download more information on this project that was submitted by some folks at Clayton County Water and CH2M Hill. And I'm happy that Kathy gave us a little more information on the Montebello Forbay project. I want to highlight a little more information on this because I think this is really a critical piece of our understanding of how we do potable reuse and how we would move forward. Because it is the oldest planned groundwater recharge project in California and has recharged a substantial amount of water into the central groundwater basin, there's been a lot of really exciting research on this project. In particular, the research has been done on health effects related to use of recycled water. And to date, on this project that's over 50 years old, there's been no documented adverse health effects. And so that really helps us have a good understanding of how we move forward and some of the treatment technologies that are applicable. UV was actually implemented on this project at the Whittier Narrows Water Reclamation Plant in 2011 in response to reducing disinfection byproducts. So another important project where UV has been implemented. I promised a little bit of time on advanced oxidation, and I also think that it's important for us to understand the mechanism of formation of hydroxyl radicals, which are the key to this process. We actually have a couple of different methods for forming hydroxyl radicals, which are very strong oxidizing potential. And if you look at some of the other chemicals that we use in water and wastewater treatment, it's quite high on the redox scale. AOP can be generated using things like a combination of ozone and hydrogen peroxide, but more commonly what we see in reuse applications is UV and hydrogen peroxide used. The reason that we do this is we sort of get a double bang for our buck. In addition to forming hydroxyl radicals using UV and hydrogen peroxide, we have a secondary benefit of photolysis. And so we actually have two separate chemical mechanisms for destruction of refractory compounds. So we're able to address compounds that have a high propensity for destruction through electrophilic substitution using the hydroxyl radical, as well as chemicals such as NDMA, which are more readily degraded through photolysis. So I want to talk about when we put UV AOP into a reuse train, and that's really where we have refractory organics. I put on this slide here, those are places where we have those organics that are regulated, such as pesticides, herbicides, but also for compounds that are not currently regulated. And those are the emerging compounds of concern, the pharmaceutical and personal care products, things like endocrine-disrupting compounds. UVAOP is able to help address these sorts of constituents in the water. These are constituents that we begin to really think about when we're doing indirect or direct potable reuse. And then I guess I'm a proponent of implementing UVAOP in drinking water applications where we do have de facto reuse. I think there's a recognition that we're beginning to have on large river systems, and this is maybe important more in the east where we are water rich. But if we think about river systems such as the Cumberland River, the Ohio River, the Mississippi River, there's a fairly high fraction of wastewater effluent in these watersheds, and so it becomes important to think about treating for these sorts of constituents. So where do we see UVAOP? I've got a slide, and you can also download this information in the U.S. EPA guidelines. But we see it frequently. The California IPR FAP model, as Kathy mentioned, as well as other projects that are from around the world. The two projects I wanted to talk about quickly, the first is San Diego. There's a nice demonstration project ongoing now It's a 1 MGD scalable pilot, and potentially, if this project goes well, ultimately this project would be scaled up to provide water to the San Vicente Reservoir, which is the water supply for San Diego. So in this demonstration project, there's a full scale of monitoring for a number of parameters regulated under Safe Drinking Water Act, as well as the state drinking water regulations. In addition, there's monitoring for constituents such as disinfection byproducts, nutrients, some of the emerging contaminants of concern, endocrine-disrupting compounds, pharmaceuticals, and personal care products. And then some process integrity surrogates, as Kathy mentioned as well. One of the unique things about this project is the public outreach and the independent advisory panel that's been created to help this project obtain public acceptance. And, of course, AOP is implemented in this project to help address some of these constituents that I listed here below. The other one that I talk about just quickly is a project that's ongoing in Texas, and this is a 2 MGD full advanced treatment project. And I think the regulatory folks in Texas are still calling this a direct blend, but in the EPA guidelines we call this direct potable reuse, where reclaimed water is going to be blended with surface water supply at about a 10 to 30% blend rate with lake water. And so this project uses UV-AOP, very similar to what is presented in some of the other California IPR projects. That's ongoing. It's a 2 MGD facility. I think the cost of the project is around $10 million and should be implemented in within the year. So with that, I just want to sort of wrap up and talk about, yes, potable reuse is an important water management tool, and it really needs a lot of focus. UV is a critical component in many of these reuse solutions, both to provide disinfection as well as advanced oxidation. And then I've left a list of references and resources here for you all today, the NWRI guidelines. Please visit waterreuse.org. There's a plethora of information there, the IUVA, as well as the site where the EPA guidelines can be downloaded. And, Andreas, that's what I have today.
Thank you very much, Katie. And that was a, you know, a very good explanation about the link of UV technology with the topic of water reuse, you know, and how it can be implemented, you know, with AOP. With that, I can open the Q&A session to the panel, and we got a few questions in, and I just will start with the first one. This is about the Colorado River, and someone asked the question that regulators and individual water districts seem to be reluctant to perform direct comparisons of recycled water to the water pulled from drinking water, and if there are any trends in that comparison. I don't know who, you know, would like to answer, but I could assume that maybe, Harold, you may have an answer or comment, at least, on that question.
Yeah, I guess I'm not totally familiar with how the regulators view the different water supplies, but I guess from our perspective is that all water should be judged on the same basis, and that would be based on the water quality. And it could be that Katie may or Kathy may have a different answer.
Yeah, this is Kathy Chang, and this is actually a really good point, very interesting point. And our agency, the Water Replenishment District of Southern California, we're in the process of getting our permit amended for our barrier injection project. And this is a point that we do actually emphasize with the regulators. And actually what we did in our discussions is prepared a comparison that looked at exactly this point, looked at the water quality of the imported potable water versus the advanced treated recycled water that's being used for at the barrier facilities. And basically the recycled water quality actually looks much better in terms of many categories, including the total organic carbon, specific conductance, turbidity, TDS, alkalinity. Those are way lower because of, you know, the advanced treatment that it the recycled water is subjected through. However, because it is of wastewater origin, even after advanced treatment, if you compare the nitrate numbers, those in the recycled water are slightly higher, even though they're way below the regulatory limit. So that's what we saw. And the regulators really like this spin because this makes it easy for them to also present this project to the public during the public hearing process.
Okay, thank you. The next question may be best addressed from Katie, and the question is, if the AOP process has been tested for the efficiency of the removal for refractory organic nitrogen and TUZ residuals, which is not typically removed by water treatment plants. Do you know this, Katie?
Yeah, and Kathy can probably jump on behind me and fill in some more blanks. But, yes, we have tested this at great extent in many installations for TOC removal efficiency. That's actually a place that we perform quite well. And then even beyond TOC, the full advanced treatment process allows us to achieve below detection limits for almost any organic parameter that we can measure. Where we do have a challenge is what Kathy mentioned as far as nitrites, and that is a little bit more challenging, and so I think there are additional treatment processes that can be implemented to supplement that if that's something that needs to be done. But again, if we're held to the same standards as drinking water standards, those limits are typically below what's required under the safe drinking water rules.
Mm-hmm. A direct follow-up question, would that mean that AOP would be an essential part of any potable reuse project because you concentrate micropollutants in the water if you do that?
I don't think it has to be an absolute critical process, but it's a very cost-effective means of achieving reduction of those sorts of constituents, as well as at the same time you're achieving credits for disinfection. And then, one of the things we didn't spend a lot of time talking about is the microbial inactivation. Kathy did highlight some of the log removals of viruses and cryptosporidium and things that we do have to achieve. Those are large reductions that are quite easily achieved under the UV and advanced oxidation scenarios.
Okay. Kathy, do you want to add anything?
Oh, no, I think Katie covered most of the points.
The next question, I think, is, very general one, and, that could be addressed by every speaker, actually. It's about, can you quantify the increased costs of reusing wastewater? And I think that depends on the individual application, what it is. Is it a decentralized project? Is it, potable reuse? But does anyone want to jump in and give a comment on that question?
Yeah, I could probably take a shot. This is Kathy Chang again. And just looking at specifically for recycled water that's purchased for use in Los Angeles County, the cost of reusing wastewater is really a fraction of the cost of imported potable water. So the potable water has been steadily increasing in price, pushing basically $1,000 per acre foot, whereas the recycled water that we've been getting for groundwater recharge is estimated around $250 to $300 per acre feet. So it's really a fraction of the cost.
Okay, thanks.
Andreas, this is Katie.
Yep.
I do want to hop on. One of the things that we sometimes lose sight of is we look at this in terms of only comparing it to drinking water cost, how much it costs to produce drinking water. The other thing that's really important in places like Florida is the cost offset for being able to discharge this water to some other place besides the surface water or to ocean outfalls. For example, in Florida, there's over 300 million gallons a day on the Atlantic coast that has to be eliminated by 2018. And so there's a huge cost in doing that. A lot of these things are also being driven in wetter areas of the country by the ability for reuse to help us remove nutrient loadings to surface water. So we need to also think about and capture that cost as well as we think about the big picture of reuse.
Yeah. Okay. The next question is more detailed again, and it is, does the CDPH have higher levels of treatment for recycled water versus drinking water imported from the Colorado River? Who wants to answer that? Casey, maybe?
I'll take a shot, and I'll just focus on just one example. Is for instance, the drinking water treatment often does not need to include the advanced treatment MFR OAOP. However, the recycled water, at least I'm going to focus specifically on that use for recharge, perhaps for the barrier injection. It does need to receive advanced treatment. And even if the water that we actually produce from our advanced water treatment plant is negative for coliform detection, however, it's not good enough. And so that we have to actually put it into the ground, and it has to remain there for over 6 months in order to receive the additional six logs of removal for virus removal. So that's not really required for drinking water. So I think that in some aspects, it is subjected to a higher level of treatment compared to potable water.
Okay, thank you. So I don't have any problem to address the next two questions, actually. They're definitely for Tom. The questions are, how does the NSF effort interface with the LED efforts, and are NSF standards subject to state-level approvals?
I'm sorry, the first question, as it relates to what? I'm sorry.
The first question is, does the NSF effort interface with the LED efforts?
Oh, I'm sorry, LEED, USGBC, right.
Okay.
Very good question. So, yes, to the first question, actually, in the draft changes to the USGBC rules related to LEED, NSF 350 is cited, as it is in some of the national plumbing codes and other state-level regulations as well. So in the context of LEED, it's really driving towards giving credits, as is the case with LEED buildings, towards water reuse applications. And so there, it's largely focused around effluent quality criteria that would be looked upon as being evaluated and suitable then for reuse applications. So yes, it does interface with LEED and is cited specifically in the changes that have yet to be adopted, but in the draft language. In terms of state regulations, yes, absolutely. I think as was mentioned earlier, there is not a federal level set of requirements around reuse. It's managed at the state level, and there certainly are states that have regulations and are considering using Standard 350 as enabler for product acceptance and product permitting, remembering again that this standard is meant to be an evaluation of treatment technologies to generate a certain level of performance. So it essentially then becomes a tool for the state health departments or the state sewage codes to enable product compliance approval to fit that particular application.
Okay, thank you. Next question is about a particular project, actually. Will the San Diego project able to go to direct reuse before it goes to full implementation? Very detailed question. Does someone know that or have an idea about that?
This is Harold.
Yeah.
I haven't been a part of the meetings in San Diego, but George has. And George mentioned that during one of the last meetings that they had with the city council, that the option of direct potable reuse was brought up, and I think so. It looks like that's getting some consideration now.
Okay. So that answers also part of the next question, which is, are there any direct potable reuse projects in the U.S.? So this may be one. And then in the world, I'm not sure who would be brave enough to answer that question.
Actually, Andreas, I'm quite brave enough to answer both of those questions.
Okay, very good.
yes, there are DPR projects it's interesting. I think some of the regulatory agencies, the two that I can think of off the top of my head are the Cloudcroft New Mexico project, and then also the Big Spring Texas project. And I think the regulatory agencies are actually calling those something like direct blend. So there are what I would consider direct potable reuse projects already sort of marching in that direction. Certainly worldwide, Namibia is a project. And then there's also another more comprehensive listing in the EPA guidelines if you want to take a look at that as well. So, yes, those are projects that are marching forward, and there are some states that are talking about developing regulations. The Water Reuse Association has established a national regulatory committee that's working with a number of states to outline the framework for how you would go about approaching such a task. So some of those states are, Arizona's actually got a group of folks who are interested in looking at DPR regs, of course, California and Florida. I was surprised to see interest from Colorado, and certainly Texas. So I think it's gaining a lot of interest from the regulatory world, and so it'll be interesting to see how those things march forward.
Okay. Very good update. Thank you. On the next question, this is about, you know, the technology, the existing technologies, and if they would be able to address the water reuse needs and what the preferred technologies are. I think, or I hope we answered that, that there are technologies existing which can address the needs, and that definitely more than just one technology needs to be combined in order, you know, to make it happen. This would just be my general answer, but if someone would like to add something on that, Harold, would you like to? You spoke about, you know, different treatment trains, and maybe you can add something.
So basically the treatment train that we looked at, which is basically membrane pretreatment before reverse osmosis and then followed by advanced oxidation, is kind of the gold standard for recycled water back for potable reuse. And basically that technology has, you know, been found to be very reliable and cost effective. And we think that, you know, going into the future, it's not hard to imagine that the technology is only going to get better and more reliable, and that you know, that anything will be possible in a short time.
Okay. The next question would be, if the panelists have sense about, you know, the split or the percentage of industrial reuse versus the amount of municipal reuse or recycling. Does anyone have an idea about that?
I could just give just a short answer based on one of the pie charts from my presentation. California, it's it represents about 7% of the total recycled water that's used, versus for the municipal uses would be, let's see, groundwater recharge, seawater intrusion. That's about 20% is related to recharge that's eventually used for municipal supply, and then irrigation represents about 50%.
Okay. And then next question would be, if the panelist sees the states or the feds mandating reuse to reduce freshwater consumption, I think the short answer is yes, but would like to anyone to add on that short answer? No? Okay, so the answer is yes. The next one is very detailed. How is the membrane integrity issue addressed for DPR? I don't know if you can answer that today. If anyone would like to step out and answer that. No, so I think that question is just too detailed. Maybe we can care about this later.
Yeah, Andreas, let me just add on there. There are surrogate parameters that are measured for individual treatment process integrity, and there's actually quite a lot of funding. Some of that funding is coming from the Water Reuse Association for development of even more advanced monitoring tools, online monitoring tools moving forward. So I think we've got some really neat potential using spectrophotometric methods that can help us do a better job of integrity testing for unit processes. But as we're looking at the treatment process train, the integrity of every single unit process is monitored. I'm not sure we actually do that good of a job in the drinking water world right now.
Okay. So you're saying in the reuse arena, that's done better than in drinking water?
Well, that's probably a little bit of an objective. I think in many cases we're more diligent because we are aware of the implications of having an unsuccessful event.
Okay, thank you. The next real question is... is there an opportunity for cost-effective use on small-scale municipal projects such as site plans or subdivisions? I think this may be a question for Tom.
Well, certainly there's opportunity for it. I think the question was raised earlier in terms of the economics of it, and I think that has regional implications, certainly in the sense of where water is plentiful versus areas clearly where it's in great shortage. So there certainly are those opportunities. I think most of that today is focused around non-potable reuse applications as opposed to direct potable reuse. But certainly as those areas develop and the technologies and the regulations enable it, I think that application too will become more prominent for those small scale opportunities.
Okay. So besides that last real question, there were lots of questions about are the slides available and so forth, and I think everyone can send a mail to Blue Tech Research and they will care about that. You will be able to get the slides for download or by other means. There are no further questions, so if no one else would like to make an additional comment, I ask the panel, is there anything left, any comment? If not, then all all which is left is that I can thank the audience, the attendees for listening to us, to thank the presenters for the great presentations, for the organizers, for that the technology really worked very well, and to the IUVA and to NSF and Blue Tech Research for making this happen. Thank you very much, and see you perhaps at the next webinar in I think 1 month from now.